Rapper Podcast this week. We're coming to you straight from San Diego for a Comic-Con special with a ton of great guests, including Ivan Reitman and the producers of Marvel's Inhumans. All that and more on the movie podcast that's been sitting down for so long, it needs preparation Hall H. Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt, and welcome to the Empire Podcast, brought to you this week from our very own studio at the San Diego Comic-Con International 2017. I say studio, it's a room at a hotel, but a room at a hotel with style and sass, and a room that's seen a whole lot of stuff happen here over the last few days. And thank you, by the way, to you, the listeners, for your patience in waiting for this week's episode. I know that it's out late, but it is Saturday night here. The con is winding down, and joining me to discuss the ins and outs and the ups and downs of this year's event are Jurassic World star and a man who was present at his own panel. No one else showed up. Edmund, my life as a man who goes to the dinosaurs. Nick Desemlian,
hello, Chris. I'm very well. Thank you. I'm not very well, actually. I'm extraordinarily tired, but it's been a very fun few days. I have not been mobbed.
Try and mob you, but I'm just one man. What can I do?
I have seen a dancing dinosaur. I'm pretty sure it was real. I may be hallucinating, but I have, everywhere I go, I seem to see this person dressed in a full T-Rex costume.
The same dinosaur.
Just dancing on the spot, just joyous.
I've seen the same dinosaur. You're not hallucinating. It's all fine. I've seen it. Do you think it was there just for you? Because it knows of your history with dinosaurs. It knows that you are Edmund from Jurassic World.
Let's say yes. Let's say yes. That would be a waste of their time, but yeah, let's say yes.
Let's say the yes. We're very tired, by the way. We should establish this right off the bat.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we'll establish that right off the bat. It's been a tough few days, but we're bullying through for you guys. And we're joined, it's not just me and Nick. We're not just doing it, the two of us. We're also joined by a shadowy figure that some call James White, but I call him Jaime Blanco, our man in LA, and a man largely in Hall H this year. How was that, Blanco? How are you?
Hi, Chris. Yes, I am fine, but also very, very tired. And I haven't.
You don't have jet lag to contend with, mate. We got the jet lag. You just drove up from the LA.
I have Hall H lag to contend with. I have spent the last 2 days in a darkened room. I've forgotten what the sun looks like.
Hall H is so vast, there are three time zones operating in there.
It's a place where the likes of people dressed as Bill and Ted and the guys from Wayne's World rub shoulders with people dressed as Bacon.
James emerged blinking from how many hours have you spent in Hall H today?
I have spent approximately 17 hours in Hall H.
You went in just before the Warner Brothers panel today, so that's 11:30.
Yes.
And you didn't emerge until after the Marvel panel, which closed the whole shebang, and that finished at about, 7?
About 7.
7 o'clock, something like that. So do a quick calculation. That's 7.5 hours.
It felt longer.
Yeah?
It really felt longer.
I particularly enjoyed, I asked James how it went when he emerged blinking into the, I had to explain what the sun was to him. And my favourite thing was when you mentioned there was a man dressed as Bacon who asked a question.
Kevin Bacon, but just Bacon.
Kevin Bacon, just a rasher of Bacon, hanging out, asking questions, doing his thing.
And that kind of makes sense. I didn't question it. That's Comic-Con.
It wasn't even a Bacon-related question, though. It was just a guy dressed as Bacon asking somebody from Westworld something about the show.
Was he on a roll?
Oh, that's good. That's good. What's your sauce for this information?
I will not sanction this buffoonery.
What's the best costume you've seen here at Comic-Con this year?
What is the
is
best
it
costume? It might be the Bacon. It might be the Bacon. Though there are some really impressive costumes here. I mean, people absolutely go all out. There are technologically complicated costumes that look like they are massively, massively uncomfortable to wear. Yeah. I, too, have seen the dancing dinosaur, so it really, really, really is not an hallucination.
It's time to work.
I've seen a lot of doctors, as in the main character from Doctor Who. Don't call him Doctor Who. He's not Doctor Who.
As established, I talked to Peter Capaldi and Stephen Moffat only hours ago.
Yep.
And they both are absolutely fine with people calling him Doctor Who.
Yep. That's ridiculous.
In your face, Hema Blanco.
Stephen Moffat even threw an episode that I've never seen. He threw an episode title back in which the Doctor says a couple of times apparently that my name is Doctor Who. Apparently he signs his name Dr. W. Capaldi grew up calling him Doctor Who. He has absolutely no problems with it. At this very, very table, in that very seat that you're sitting in right now, Peter Capaldi, the 12th Doctor, the man who's the current incumbent of the role, said that his name is Doctor Who. Suck on that, boy.
He's wrong. You're all wrong. The world is wrong. And I'm right on this
talking
point.
Talking of Doctor Who costumes, John Barrowman, I didn't see this in person, but he came on stage, I think on Thursday, wearing a dress, a TARDIS dress, to celebrate Jodie Whittaker becoming the 13th Doctor.
Wow. In you know, in his defense, though, that's pretty much just Thursday for John Barrowman.
It just happened that Jodie Whittaker happened to have been hired, but
he already had the dress.
It worked out well. Yeah,
is it bigger on the inside? Is John Barrowman bigger on the inside,
Chris?
So, talking of costumes, I've seen some really good ones. Obviously, yeah, I've seen a Predator. I've seen some Ghostbusters. Uh-huh. I was interviewing Ivan Reitman for this very episode of the podcast. When three Ghostbusters walked past, not Bill Murray, and got him to spotted him and got him to sign their costumes. I think my favourite is Carl from Up. There was a guy dressed.
Took a picture of that, didn't you?
Absolutely incredible.
I've seen a lot of things this year because we haven't really been out of this room, you or I in particular. You haven't really been out of Hall H. Nick and I haven't really been out of this studio. The fruits of which you are going to see in the next issue of Empire, in particular, I would say, if you've been watching stuff, well, I did a lot of Facebook Live things over in the corner of the room here on our new kick-ass little Mevo camera. We did a whole bunch of photo shoots and interviews with people. You'll see the next issue of Empire on sale, All Good News and Evil News Agents, on August 10th. But by and large, we haven't really been out. So when we get to discussing the news that people have been seeing at this convention, Blanco, you're going to be doing a lot of heavy lifting here. I did get out for one panel, and that panel was, hey, it's me. I'm wearing Kevin Feige underpants. It was the Marvel panel. It's the golden ticket that ends my Comic-Con. And it was amazing and mind-blowing. We also saw The Tick, didn't we? We saw the second episode of The Tick.
We did.
And we'll talk about that maybe a little later. And Nick, you also saw?
I saw Star Trek Discovery quite recently. Yeah. From right at the back of Ballroom 20.
Yeah.
Are there really 20 ballrooms?
It struck me. I've been coming to Comic-Con, and my apologies for anyone who's listening to this going, this is a strange episode of the Emperor podcast, and also, what the fuck is Comic-Con? If you don't know what Comic-Con is the, and I'm glad we've started this 8 minutes into the podcast, and I'm explaining finally what Comic-Con is. Comic-Con is the world's largest pop culture festival, and it is insanely big, and it takes place here at the San Diego Convention Center over 4 days, well, maybe 5 days, every July, and it is massive, and studios, Hollywood studios, have taken it over the years and bring all their wares here. Well, most of them bring their wares here, and they show them off to 135,000 adoring fans can line the halls of the convention center over that period. An astonishing amount of people.
And a few dinosaurs as well.
And bacon.
It's bacon. An extraordinary event. I haven't been here for the last couple of years. I've missed it intensely. When I get here, I'm largely miserable. But I also have an amazing time. And I've had a great, great time this year. We've had some fantastic people coming into our little studio here. And I've seen some cool shit. But my point was costumes. And I haven't seen a lot because I haven't really been out. I've noticed there's a propensity this year for women in particular, and I'm not being lascivious, I haven't been looking pervy like Sid James, but to body paint themselves. Have you noticed that? Instead of going for costumes. And so I'm not sure whether that's a sponsored thing. Because also, some of the costumes I've seen this year, I saw a huge Rocket Raccoon yesterday. I saw like a 6-foot-tall Rocket Raccoon with a massive gun. And I was wondering, is that a guy cosplaying, and he's worked on it all year, and he loves Rocket Raccoon, and he loves Guardians of the Galaxy, or is it to coincide with the DVD, which is coming out in August, and is it some jobbing actor in a suit?
Yeah, I saw some Kubo and the Two Strings people with amazing costumes. It turned out they were actually official Leica kind of people who were on site, so that was
Leica
a bit disappointing.
A lot. Yeah.
They were pretty amazing.
I was invited to the Leica experience. There's a Leica experience here, and I haven't been able to go yet. But hopefully tomorrow, as the con winds down, maybe I'll find the time to do it. I walk the floor properly. I haven't really done that yet. I bought one T-shirt, which really pissed off Nick, because he saw it first, and he wanted it. It was a Ghostbuster T-shirt, and I nipped in there. And I got it.
Very upsetting.
You can buy the same t-shirt, man. You can just...
We can't wear the same t-shirt.
I can wear it on a Tuesday. You can wear it on a Thursday. It's fine. It's okay. Dan and I used to have the same t-shirts. Why can't we have the same t-shirts? We share everything else. We don't. We don't share anything else. Okay, right. So as you've noticed, this is an atypical episode of the Empire Podcast. We're not starting with a question from the listeners. That's going to be back next week when the show returns to its normal format. So instead, we're going to start with a guest. And we wanted to start the show with a man who had a great directorial career, who was responsible for some of the best love comedies of all time. And we were thinking we also wanted someone whose son had also forged a great career behind the camera. You know, we looked at a ton of candidates, and then we decided that Ivan was the right man for the job. Nick, who loves Ghostbusters 2 more than he loves life itself, and indeed the original Ghostbusters, went along to talk to Ivan Reitman, for it is he, about a new Ghostbusters comic. This is interesting, and more besides in this 7-minute interview from the heart of the Comic-Con floor. Amazing 7 minutes. Do enjoy.
So we are delighted to be joined at San Diego Comic-Con by Ivan Reitman. How are you doing, sir?
Hi. It's a madhouse here.
It sure is. You must be a Comic-Con hero. I just walked past some people dressed as Ghostbusters. You must be treated as a living god here.
I try not to be. I try to keep my mortality as long as I can.
So is this your first Comic-Con, or have you been a bunch of times?
It actually is my first Comic-Con. I've always tried to stay away. And I used to go to 3E. I've gone, you know, a few times in Los Angeles. But I think it may be my second, actually, here.
What are your impressions of wandering around?
Well, it's fun. You know, just from doing the panel... you know, people are real fans. They've appreciated the work and show an enormous amount of love and goodwill. What's not to like? It's a great thing.
Yeah. And you're here to promote a new Ghostbusters comic book?
Yeah. You know, one of the things I wanted to try is putting the two worlds, the classical worlds of my first two movies and then Paul Feig's sort of reboot of the Ghostbusters from last year. I mean, I thought the movie was very funny, but I know there was an enormous amount of disappointment because it didn't connect to the original set of films and characters, and the audiences felt something really missing. So I know there's a lot of talk about gender, but I actually thought the gender stuff was really not the issue. I think it was really not connecting it with the historical films. So... I wanted to try to put it together to see how that would feel and how it would work. And I thought using the comic book, which has been very popular for us, throughout the 80s, as a good testing ground for the story. And certainly the most ardent fans who are also comic book collectors were going to let us know whether they liked this idea or not. And so far they've loved it.
So in this world, I guess there are two people who look like Dan Aykroyd and two people who look like Bill Murray, because they were playing different characters in that.
If you're going to take it exactly like that, my real objective is to not to have two separate universes, make it kind of a historical thing. The Ghostbusters, the original sort of 1984, 1989 Ghostbusters came first, and then later on... this group from Answer the Call have taken over.
And are you a bit of a comic book enthusiast? Because you're obviously involved in Heavy Metal, which is a film I really like, from Crazy Film.
As a kid, I was a huge comic book fan. You know, especially those old, eerie, creepy, ones. Look, I like the Disney cartoons. I like DC. I was really broad. I like Mad Magazine, which was really a cartoon back then. A comic book, not a cartoon. And... So I think I understand why fans continue to go.
Yeah. And, I mean, Heavy Metal is a completely nuts film. I saw it again really recently, and it's...
Yeah, I'm really proud of it. Nothing like that had been done. I think I did it in 1987 or something, or I can't even remember when I did it. But I was a fan of the magazine, and I knew the publishers of the magazine because I had done Animal House with them. It was... The same sister, same overall company that did both magazines, And they had asked if I could help do the film, and I said sure, and really just had a great time doing it.
Yeah. And just go back to Ghostbusters. I saw that recently the animated TV series was announced.
We put it on a hold. We got a lot of inquiries and interest from different television networks to put it on. And then at the last second, we decided to hold on the deal and really focus on the new Ghostbusters animated feature and sort of have that kick off the world. And I think it's because I knew the animated feature was going to bring, was going to at least go a long way to get back the classical story that we had originally started. And I wanted that to come first.
And does having animated series and comic books and all this, does it allow you to go wilder with your storylines to come up with crazier stuff?
Well, it gives you, it allows you to sort of look into a much broader kind of thing. You know, the pressure on a live action comedy feature right now and the cost that's involved is just too much, and and you're always second guessing yourself. It's what's great about, you know, the IDW comic books. You really can try some stuff.
Because I know Dan Aykroyd tends to dream big. I'm a Ghostbusters 2 fan, and I know that his original story for that was involved Scotland and this crazy tube that people could travel in for 3 days, and fairies and elves and all kinds of stuff. Like,
I think he's a genius who's got this really broad range of things that he can do, and part of the balance between Dan and Harold Ramis and myself allowed for the movie that we have to come out.
Yeah. Now, you haven't directed anything since 2014. You haven't directed since 2014, Draft Day?
Yes.
Have you got anything planned? Are you coming back?
Well, I was working on a summer of a comedy based on my life, actually.
Oh, wow, really?
The Summer of Love, 1967, with a lot of music, and I couldn't put it together in time to shoot this summer. I would have had to start it about a month ago, and I just ran out of time, so I'm going to try to put it off for next year.
Is Triplets still bubbling away? That's one that we
still
talk about in the office.
Away. We're going to get a draft in about 4 or 5 weeks, I'm told.
Really?
It seems all three actors are really serious about doing it.
So this is the two original guys and Eddie Murphy.
That is correct.
I mean, the mind boggles at that. That sounds amazing.
Yes. Well, it's either going to be really fabulous or, oh my God.
I want to see it either way. Final question for you, Ivan. Obviously, Ghostbusters toys, we're surrounded by toys and figurines and comic books, everything. What's your favorite bit of Ghostbusters merchandise? Do you have a favorite thing?
Almost everything to do with the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man. It's so delightful and makes you want to hold it and just play with it. It's not like an action play toy. It's more of a cuddle.
Do you own one? Do you have, do
oh,
you have
we
one?
Got all kinds of them.
You don't have a fire pole in your house, though.
What kind of pole?
A fire pole. You don't have a pole in your...
No, but we have one in our office.
That's pretty cool.
Yes. Yeah.
Ivan Reitman, thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, so that was Ivan Reitman. How was it? Because I'm not going to pretend to even... I'm not even going to listen to that. But how was it?
He was very nice. I wish it had been longer than 7 minutes. It's hard.
I've said that before.
I'm kind of amazed that we even managed to do that in the middle of the floor. She's like trying to do an interview in the middle of a whirlpool.
I haven't said that before.
While dancing dinosaurs are cavorting all around you.
It's
but
crazy.
Yeah, it was good. It wasn't the deep dive into Ghostbusters 2 I've been hoping for, but that'll have to wait for another time.
Absolutely. All right, let's talk about movie news. There's tons of movie news. Strap yourselves in. This is going to be a big, long segment because stuff has happened here at Comic-Con and stuff has happened elsewhere before Comic-Con happened, and we will address all of that.
I don't remember the time before Comic-Con.
I kind of vaguely do remember a time before Comic-Con. Let's leave Comic-Con to the end. And let's start off with saying farewell to two beloved figures who'd passed away this week. One is John Hurd, who I think is who passed away today at the age of 72. great character actor. I think a lot of people will remember him for his work as Kevin McAllister's dad in the Home Alone movies, but there was more to him than that. He had a great line in morally skewed types in the likes of Cutter's Way, which is a great film if you haven't seen that, with Jeff Bridges, and Cat People. He was in the remake of Cat People as well. People were praising today, in particular I saw people praising his turn in the first season of The Sopranos,
yep.
Which was Emmy nominated. Very, very good actor, one of those guys, one of the 27%ers, as we say in Empire, is someone who improves a film by 27% every time they appear on screen, and just a really dependable guy.
Yeah, he's in Snake Eyes as well.
He is in Snake Eyes.
Very much like him. Yeah, he just popped up in a lot of things. He was always good. I liked him in The Sopranos as well.
Yeah, he was fantastic. Really, really great actor. 72 years old. That's no age at all. And also this week, really, really sad news that the great George A. Romero passed away after a short battle with cancer. And this one hit me hard, I'll be honest. He's a director whose work shaped my love of film and my love of horror films. And we had him on the podcast a few years ago for a special, which you can listen to if you want to do that. I had interviewed him a whole bunch of times for the magazine. I went and set Land of the Dead, his Return to the Zombie Genre, in 2004. That was when I went and set. It came out in 2005. Interviewed him a bunch after that as well. And he was always such a lovely man. You know, the archetypal gentle giant. He was about 6'5", something like that. And he just towered over you. But he always had time for you. He always had, he was very generous with his time, and always suffered and tolerated my really, really stupid questions with grace. But as a filmmaker, he was extraordinary. And I gravitate naturally towards the Dead trilogy, the original Dead trilogy. I think, even George Romero would have admitted that the second Dead trilogy wasn't as successful as the first, both critically and commercially. But the first, this is a man who was a pioneer. He invented an entire genre, effectively, with the zombie genre, with Night of the Living Dead, and then Dawn of the Dead, and then, in my opinion, the greatest of them all, Day of the Dead. And he was a man who was ahead of his time. He was very progressive. He cast African-American leads and female leads in horror films long before it was the norm. And he was an extraordinary figure within horror and within other areas of filmmaking as well.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, he launched an entire genre of movie. Edgar Wright's written a really good piece, which is online, you can read about. He kind of launched his career with Shaun of the Dead. You know, Walking Dead is one of the biggest shows on TV, and that's directly inspired by him.
Yep.
Just, I think the zombie genre is kind of bigger now than it ever has been, and it's all down to this one man, which is pretty amazing.
Yeah, it's kind of amazing, and I also feel, the last few years of his career, he was locked back into the zombie thing, and I do feel a little sad in a way that those movies, Land of the Dead and Diary of the Dead, Survival of the Dead, were his last films, and I think he was fine. He was happy with that. He was happy with working again because he was really struggling to get films made after Bruiser, the film he made with Jason Fleming, which was a really good film, but didn't do anything at the box office, and I don't think was particularly well received critically. And he was one of those the generation of directors like John Landis and Joe Dante and people like that, John Carpenter, who for some reason are really, really struggled and are really struggling to get films made. And so whenever the zombie revival happened, he obviously was invited to come back into that, and the godfather of gore, the Dawn of the Dead, whatever you want to call him. And he jumped at the chance, and he made three films, and I'm glad that he was getting films made and getting work done. But there was something. There was always more to George Romero than zombies, and he always had more to say. And he was someone who always, I think, pushed against Hollywood a little bit. And I would have loved to have seen some of the pet projects, his version of The Stand, come to the big screen. But what a body of work.
And he was a guy who just inspired entire generations of other filmmakers. The outpouring of love for this man on Twitter, everywhere else. One of the nicest moments, I have to say, of Comic-Con this year was listening to Greg Nicotero, who, of course, got his start with George, just paying sort of homage to this man, just explaining what an impact it had on his life and his career. And there are people from Edgar Wright, all sorts of people, just absolutely praising him for being so groundbreaking, for spinning gold out of the thriftiest of budgets, and for just inspiring so many filmmakers' love of movies themselves and getting them into the business.
Tom Savini as well. I think their first collaboration was Martin, which is 1978. You mentioned things other than zombies. That was a vampire film.
Mm-hmm.
I think Romero once said that was his favourite of his own films.
Yeah,
which is interesting. So that's definitely worth hunting that down and having a look.
Yeah, it's certainly one that has really popped up again and again this week on Twitter. People going, you know, there was more to George Romero than three greatest zombie movies of all time. Martin's a fantastic film. Creepshow's got this lovely kitsch sensibility going on. If you want to see a young Ed Harris dancing, you could do a lot worse than watch Creepshow, which has got these incredible turns from Leslie Nielsen and young Ted dancing, and it's just a lot of fun. There's Monkey Shines, there's a Stephen King adaptation, The Dark Half. I'm probably forgetting some because I'm doing this off the top of my head. Oh, Knight Riders. My God, Knight Riders, which is a film that I think is probably closest to his sensibilities than maybe the horror stuff. And it's a completely bizarre film. It's got Ed Harris in it. It's a modern day Arthurian legend, but with people who ride motorbikes. And it's if you can check that out, it's really, really great. But yeah. I mean, for me, it's the horror stuff. For me, it's the zombie stuff. Dawn of the Dead blew my mind when I first saw it. It absolutely blew me away, and it's fantastic. And the soundtrack is great to this day, and everything about that film is amazing. But it's Day of the Dead. It's Day of the Dead for me, and which is a really bleak and I think really alarmingly prescient film with one of the great villains and one of the great zombies in Bub. So you know, check it out if you haven't seen any of the Romero films. Check that out. And of course, the same day, it was announced that Martin Landau had also passed away. The great Oscar-winning Martin Landau.
He was an amazing man. He was a character actor in many ways, but who could do such things with his character work that he became one of the most memorable of that genre, an Oscar winner mm-hmm. for Ed Wood, for his magnificent performance in Ed Wood. And also one of the most sort of memorable things about him was he turned everything back around and tutored other actors. He was a big part of the Actors Studio, and he taught so many actors.
Taught Ted Nicholson.
He did, yeah.
And Oliver Stone. That one didn't work out.
You can't win them all.
You can't, yeah.
But he went another way, Oliver Stone. He went in a different direction.
He did okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
But he could do everything. He could do, you know, very likable, sort of gentle character on screen, like Ed Wood, and he could play a dastardly villain like he did in North by Northwest. Like mm-hmm. he had such an incredible range. But he was always just brilliant in whatever he popped up in. So Crimes and Misdemeanors.
Yeah,
it's Crimes one of my and Misdemeanors. Favorites. Got Absolutely. To see that on the big screen recently.
Yeah. Yeah. Mission Impossible, Space 1999, a show I grew up watching.
Me too, particular favourite.
Yeah, as well. And of course, because it's me, I got to mention the fact that he was in Columbo. I got to mention it. I got to do it. He was in, I believe it was season two episode. He plays twins. And yeah, they both did it. And yeah, he was very, very good in that, going up against Peter Falk. But Columbo got him.
I always, I have a soft spot for his cameo in Entourage, which I think is one of the best. He doesn't play himself. He plays a doddery, out-of-touch producer who okay. no one wants to make a movie with, and his catchphrase is, it says something you might be interested in, and everyone's trying to get out the room with him, but he's just very, very funny in that. So,
oh, man, what a week. Martin Landau, George Romero, John Hurt, great talents all, and we're very, very sad to see them go. And also, in pre-Comic-Con news, although it definitely touches upon Comic-Con, it is in Comic-Con's wheelhouse, is the news that Peter Capaldi is passing the torch. We knew that was going to happen. We knew that he was going to regenerate in the Christmas special this year. And the smart money, I think, was on finally there being a female doctor or a black doctor. And they revealed it on Sunday during the Wimbledon final. After the Wimbledon final, actually, during it would have been weird, although it was a bit of a possession for Roger Federer. So they could have done it and not really missed a beat. And Sue Barker, did you see it?
I did not.
Sue Barker, who's a presenter of Wimbledon, BBC Wimbledon, clearly not giving a shit. I went, whoa, let's try and find out who number 13 is. And then unlike the previous time when Capaldi was announced, where they had a TV show with people who clearly didn't know anything about Doctor Who on to talk about it. Like, I think One Direction were on that show. I can't remember. And then they unveiled Capaldi. It was a big, big deal. This was just a pre-shot sequence where the new Doctor picks up the key to the TARDIS. And the new Doctor is?
The new Doctor is Jodie Whittaker.
And who's he? Is he... Is this Jodie... Because it can't be a woman, right? I mean, that would be... The Doctor cannot be a woman. That's madness, isn't it?
It's fair to say that it may in some ways have broken the internet. There were an awful lot of dribbling blokes who decided to launch themselves upon YouTube comment pages and anywhere you can make your voice heard on the internet.
Saying things like, it's Doctor Who, not Mrs. Doctor Who.
Yes. And, oh no, will the TARDIS now have a room for bras?
Oh my God.
That's quite a good one.
The best comment I saw... The best, because yes, it is a woman. It's Jodie Whittaker is a woman. What? So the new Doctor Who is a woman. First time ever. Blanco, you're the Doctor Who fan.
It's the first time. The first time the Doctor has been a woman. Though technically, the character did become a woman in the form of Joanna Lumley in the comic relief spoof, Case of Fatal Death, written by current and now outgoing showrunner Stephen Moffat.
This is why we bring you in. This is it. You know this shit. This is amazing. But yeah, so it is the best comment I saw about Jodie Whittaker, the best ridiculous comment from a jumped up man baby, was time travel is for men.
Yes, it's extremely difficult to believe that the time traveling two-hearted and incredibly ancient alien could be a woman. Wow, that really stretches the boundaries of reality there.
That's the breaking point. Yeah.
That was the breaking point.
There were clues. I mean, in the last series, there was a bit of dialogue between the Doctor and his companion, Bill. She says, Time Lord's a bit flexible on the whole man-woman thing. And he says, we're the most civilization in the universe. We're billions of years beyond your petty human obsession with gender and its associated stereotypes. So they were setting it up.
We've seen Time Lords become Time Ladies. We've seen Time Ladies before. And, of course, the Master. John Sims' version of the Master, the Doctor's big enemy / old friend / whatever, has regenerated into the character of Missy. Played by Michelle Gomez. So yeah,
Jason Isaacs at the Star Trek panel today. Jason Isaacs said, "Female Doctor Who, female lead of a Star Trek show. Now we just need a female president of the United States. And it's the full house." So did he say 2 out of 3?
I don't know, guys. I don't know about this. This feels like it's pushing the envelope a little bit too much. It's political correctness gone mad, is what it is. It's what's happening. No, this is fantastic. But you know, it's Peter Capaldi, not Patrick Capaldi. It's a TARDIS, not the TARDISN'T. I'm not the world's biggest Doctor Who fan or the world's biggest Doctor Who watcher, but I will certainly watch the first episode, at least, that Jodie Whittaker is in, because she's an amazing actress. She's fantastic. Ever since I think I first saw her in Venus, Roger Michell's Venus, a few years ago, she's phenomenal in the likes of Broadchurch. She's really, really great in that. I'm not sure if I can say that I've seen an upcoming movie in which she stars with Paddy Considine, but if I had seen that movie, I could tell you she's amazing in that as well. Yeah, she's a fantastic actress. She can play everything. She can be bubbly, she can be sensitive, she can be dramatic, and I think she's going to be great.
She can be timey-wimey.
She could be timey-wimey.
And Broadchurch, of course, this is where I push my spectacles, if I wore them, up my nose. Broadchurch, of course, is where she worked with Chris Chibnall, who is the guy who's going to come in and take over writing and producing Doctor Who for the next however many years.
It was really interesting because the upcoming Christmas special will be Stephen Moffat looked after, but then he's handing it over, so the end of the episode will be made by the new showrunner.
He's regenerating into Chris Chibnall.
So that's kind of interesting. I wonder if you can tell the exact point where they starts using different camera lenses. Or
I figure the regeneration bit's probably going to be the giveaway there.
You might be right.
Yeah.
But I think the furore over this is ridiculous. Stop being man, baby. Stop getting upset because, you know, women are playing roles that you think are designated for men. It's stupid. And well done. Jodie Whittaker, fantastic. Right, should we talk about some Comic-Con stuff?
Why not?
Let's do it.
Let's talk about Comic-Con stuff. What's the best thing you've seen in Comic-Con this year? Whew. And maybe we'll get into a sort of brief panel by panel breakdown. But the best thing, the one thing that just sticks in your mind.
Well, I think you, Chris, and I might be in slight agreement over this. But
is it a man dressed as Bacon? I didn't see him, but I want to. I want to lick him.
It was not the man dressed as Bacon who I should have gone up and asked if his name was Kevin.
Was he streaking? Sorry, I'm done. I'm officially done now.
Yeah. I don't want to egg you on, but that was a good pun.
Retiring.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, please. Yeah, I would have to say that probably my favorite thing, and interestingly, it was something that I didn't get to see last weekend because it was shown last weekend at Disney's big D23 event, an event at which I was mostly in another darkened room, the press room, and mostly was talking to people as opposed to watching footage. But Marvel brought what can only be described as an epic with about three capital E's sizzle reel for Avengers Infinity War, in which we see most of the Marvel Universe throw down against Thanos, to which Thanos, of course, replies by throwing a planet back at them. It's a wonderful thing. It's the blockbuster you can only imagine that they could make at this point.
Does he dribble the planet first like a basketball, or does
he? Does not.
It's not a planet.
Is it an asteroid? Is it a comet?
It's
a moon.
If it's at best a moon. Mm-hmm. It's an orbital body, but it's not a planet.
We need Brian Cox here to either Brian Cox. Yeah. Will do. Yeah. To explain what's going on.
But it's a wonderful thing. It's all sorts of amazing. It's the sort of dream movie you can only imagine at this point with Marvel. It's Black Panther with an army. It's Captain America with a beard. For people who like that sort of thing.
On his face. He's not. Yeah.
No. It's many different things. It's the Guardians of the Galaxy, for example, meeting Thor, actually literally bumping into him. He sort of smacks up against their ship window, and Rocket suggests they try and get it off, much like a bug against the window. Yeah. And there's lots of different amazing little things that to see.
Yeah, it's this was the culmination of the Marvel panel, which ended. Comic-Con is still going on. It'll go on tomorrow, but effectively, this is it. And the Marvel panel is always now has become the traditional curtain closer, if that such a thing exists, for Comic-Con, and it didn't disappoint. And I'm really intrigued to hear what the Warner Brothers panel was like with all the DC stuff and how that went down, especially post Wonder Woman, which is really cool to see. But the Marvel panel was amazing, and every time I come back, and I haven't been to Comic-Con for the last 2 years for various reasons, but I was just I was very, very excited to be back in that room, and I always liked the Beatlemania. And it's always amazing to hear. I have to say that there were some people behind me who were screaming every single time a different hero appeared in the Infinity War footage, like screaming, "Oh my god!"
Are you 100% sure it wasn't you?
It wasn't me. To the point where I couldn't hear the dialogue, and it was just like, "Okay,
I can't hear my own screams."
I get it.
Screams, guys.
It's Captain America with a beard, and oh my god, it's Captain America with a beard. But you know,
just a beard enthusiast.
I couldn't hear what Thor was saying to the Guardians, and I'd quite like to hear what Thor was saying to the Guardians. But yeah, it's fine.
The mood in that room is hard to describe if you haven't been in it. I mean, I haven't seen the Beatles live in the '60s, but I imagine it was similar. I don't know, James. Did the Warners do their thing where their screens wrapped around the side of the room because people go bananas?
The Warners team did indeed do that trick, which they've done a couple of times before. It's basically a big reveal where the main screen lights up and then these giant curtains pull back, and these huge screens either side sort of pull back and do their thing. They can throw logos up there, they can throw footage up there. They for example used it to plot a timeline that charts from the original Blade Runner to Blade Runner 2049, which was one of the movies they brought in for their presentation. There's a whole lot of little details about things that happen in between the two movies that inform Blade Runner 2049, which was kind of interesting.
So were people screaming at the timeline?
People were not screaming at the timeline. It has to be said that
just a baffled silence.
The Warners...
When Harrison Ford comes out with a laser pointer and he's talking you through it.
The Warners panel. The Warners panel does not quite have... It didn't quite have... It certainly had... some moment, you bring Steven Spielberg out on Hall H for his film Ready Player One, adapted from the book, and you bring Steven Spielberg out on stage and people will react to
Did
that.
Did he drop an F-bomb? I heard that he dropped an F-bomb.
I don't remember a Spielbergian F-bomb.
I'm going to take it as scurrilous.
Perhaps my brain simply wanted to filter it out because I don't believe Spielberg would swear.
I think that was someone being. I think it was someone who's on a Comic-Con being frivolous on Twitter.
Right. Yeah,
and then it was someone else later on misattributing a Denis Villeneuve quote.
Yes,
to Steven Spielberg.
Denis Villeneuve definitely did do the. As I believe his answer to the question, "Why did you want to make Blade Runner?" was, "I didn't want to see someone else F it up."
The room can get pretty. Hall H can get pretty raunchy.
Fuck it up.
I think you know, the bright panel,
language.
The bright panel in particular turned into Will Smith delirious, and it was like him talking about. It was pretty funny. Like, yeah, he was doing some euphemisms involving magic wands and talking about the time he first had sex and how it wasn't as good as the first time he saw Star Wars, and then realized at the end that there were lots of kids in the audience, and so apologized. But yeah, David Ayer swore up a storm, as David Ayer is prone to do. Yeah. I think he came out going, "Motherfucking Netflix!" you gotta love David Ayer. He's great, but just effing and jeffing.
Effing and jeffing. Which I really want to see that as a CBB show, don't you? Just effing. Hello, effing. Hello, jeffing. What are you doing today? Fuck knows. But there was a really funny moment during the Thor Ragnarok part of the Marvel panel where Mark Ruffalo came out, and he went, Hulk in this movie, he kicks some A. And he went, and the reason I didn't say the full word is because I've just seen in the back of this card that you must be aware that there are some people in the audience who are under the age of 18. Then everyone else started to say the word ass instead. It's certainly interesting. So we'll finish with Marvel. We'll talk about, let's talk about the Warner Brothers panel, and let's talk about the beginning of that, which was indeed Ready Player One. The trailer is now out there, or at least the Comic-Con trailer is now out there, the teaser, for all to see, with I just have to point this out, with one of the strangest credits I've ever seen.
Okay.
So Steven Spielberg on the trailer is hailed, he's not visionary, we're beyond visionary now, okay, we're beyond genius or legend or any of that stuff. Steven Spielberg is credited on the trailer as the cinematic game changer Steven Spielberg. That's fine. That's okay. You could technically say that Steven Spielberg changed cinema, right?
Oh, he did.
Yeah?
He did.
Yeah, surely.
Okay, so that's good. We're all happy with that. The book itself, which is written by Ernest Klein, is referred to, and I haven't written it down here, so I'm going off completely off my memory here, a holy grail of pop culture.
Which doesn't really mean anything, right? I mean, a holy grail is something that people, you look for very hard, and mm-hmm. it's hard to find.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It may not exist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
This book does exist. We have a copy of it here.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep.
It's here. I found it fairly easily.
Yeah.
So maybe they're comparing it to Monty Python's Holy Grail, and they're just saying it's a bit silly.
Yeah.
I don't know. It sounds quite impressive.
I would go so far as to say, and this may be a bit strong, I'm a bit tired, who knows, that it's the worst sentence in the history of the English language.
You haven't read Ready Player One?
I'm about
sorry.
To.
Sorry.
Well,
it's fine. It's fine.
It's a diabolical sentence. No. That should be. What does that even mean? A holy grail of pop culture. What is that?
Are you saying that they chose poorly?
I would say that they chose poorly, but let's talk about Ready Player One. Let's talk about the trailer. Let's set it up. Blanco, you were there.
Mm-hmm.
What is it? Tell us about it.
Ready Player One is the book by a guy called Ernest Klein, and it's a world. It's set in a world where essentially most people like to disappear into virtual reality. There is a massive universe in virtual reality called the Oasis, where this is not that Oasis. Don't look back in anger. The world has basically become a dystopia. There are visions, and you can see them in the trailer of the stacked like skyscrapers. There is not a lot of money. There are bad conditions, and people just like to disappear into this virtual world because you can be anything, you can do anything, you can drive the DeLorean, you can hang out with the Iron Giant, you can go to nightclubs, you can fly around in space, anything you can imagine, you can basically do. And the creator of this amazing virtual place has died, and he's left these little Easter eggs for people to find. Mm-hmm. And if you follow the trail and you find everything, you basically inherit the Oasis. You basically take everything. It's as if Steve Jobs left the sort of like the clues to his fortune, and you could inherit his fortune, which I'm sure his daughter probably wouldn't be too thrilled about. So yeah, it's basically that, and we follow a young man named Wade Watts.
Wait, what?
Who's played by Ty Sheridan. Are you trying to be the game changer of criticism here?
this podcast is a holy grail of me going,
We follow a young man who is obsessed with being in this virtual world, and he starts a mission to try and find it, and there's some big, bad sort of corporate people who would rather he didn't and would rather they did, and they are represented in another slightly scowly bad guy turn by Ben Mendelsohn, who might also be making appearances on Empire's Facebook Live, and he's essentially trying to get this the keys to the Oasis and all the fortune and everything that comes with for his corporate overlords.
Yeah. Oh, and what time is it in this virtual world? Is it midnight at the Oasis, or is it 4 a.m.? Anyway, hey, it's very good that you explained that to me, because I got none of that from the teaser trailer. So
you really wouldn't get that.
There's a lot going on, not just in the world, but in the story. It's kind of a bit Avatar-y in that it has, you know, some of it's going to be live action. I think I read it's going to be 40% live action and 60% set inside the virtual world, which is just like Scott Pilgrim is another thing I think about when I kind of think about this. Is stuffed with pop culture references, video game stuff. I mean, I can only speak for the book, so I don't know what's exactly in the film. The book is stuffed with Steven Spielberg references, interestingly, which he said he's taken out.
Well, obviously, in the trailer today that you can all see now, the DeLorean from Back to the Future is in there, which is obviously Steven Spielberg produced. Alan Silvestri is going to score the film, because John Williams is too busy scoring Steven Spielberg's other movie, The Papers, which is coming out like 3 months before this one, even though he started it like 2 weeks ago. You're right, Freddy Krueger, which Steven Spielberg had nothing to do with, but he's in there. So is the Iron Giant. So is Kaneda's bike from Akira, which is seen in a chase sequence alongside the Back to the Future.
So maybe it needed Steven Spielberg. It's like Who Framed Roger Rabbit, where you need somebody who can get the right, who everyone will say yes to.
That's exactly why I went to the press conference, and Zach Penn, the writer, maybe some other people as well, said that that's exactly what happened. That, you know, Spielberg would come in and go, "Oh, we should do this," and they would go, "You'll never get the rights for that." And he went, "Of course I will. I'm Steven Spielberg, and I would just call these people direct, and then it would happen."
He called the Iron Giant direct.
He did call the Iron Giant direct. He had retired.
How did
he
get his number?
Yeah, well, you call Vin Diesel, who's pretty close to the Iron Giant, and you get the number, you get the digits.
What do you mean, Vin Diesel's close? How does Vin Diesel know the Iron Giant? What? How?
James, I need to have a long chat with you after this about how Iron Giants are made.
No, I don't want
to
know.
Sort of dodgy sort of lines of text aside, I thought the trailer was fun. There's a lot going on in it. Some of the orcs from The Hobbit appear to have got into the trailer somehow. There are some kind of orky looking characters, or at least one. It's kind of the kind of thing you can go frame by frame, because I'm sure they're all stuffed with little obscure references and not so obscure references.
It's a difficult book to adapt beyond even getting the rights to everything that you could possibly try and get, mostly because the story is kind of sprawling. It feels like the sort of thing that would probably work more as a sort of a miniseries on HBO or something like that, where you could give it, you know, 10 hours or something to really explore this world, because it's a huge, huge virtual world. I guess we have to wait and see how they've pared it down into what, a 2-hour movie, 2.5-hour movie, 17-hour movie. We'll see.
Absolutely. I'll be honest, the trailer did not blow me away. It looks fairly generic, a bit confusing. I'm sure future trailers will sort that out. It is our former boss, our boy, the Berg. I'm sure he'll pull it out of the bag. I'm reading the source material when we get back. I have a copy of the novel here now. But my understanding is that this book splits people down the middle. Some people say it's really good. Some people say it's a holy grail of pop culture. Other people say it's rubbish. So I'm very intrigued. Jaws it's not a great book, and one of the greatest films of all time was produced from it.
I have no worries about it, because I think the writing is not necessarily the best, but I think the concept and the skeleton of the story is very strong, and so I can see totally why Spielberg would want to turn it into a movie, and so hopefully they'll strengthen the bits that need vitamins. And I think it's I'm excited by it. think it's going to be it's Steven Spielberg's Avatar, and I think that's you've got to be excited about that, right?
Pretty much, yeah. This feels like a perfect film for Steven Spielberg to make. It is almost literally a film that only Steven Spielberg could get made. And we'll see. It channels a lot of the things he likes to put in movies. You know, a young man's adventures, and you know, just an incredibly vast story. So we'll see. Fingers crossed.
Also, in the Warner Brothers panel, we had Blade Runner 2049.
We did indeed.
I haven't seen the previous 20. Anyway, so do you? What do they show? What did they see?
They showed a little bit more. The panel was actually introduced by a hologram of Jared Leto.
The best version of Jared Leto.
Really?
Yeah.
Because he's, he wasn't actually there. He was simply just projected. And but I do believe he did actually go very method for it and was a hologram around his house for at least 6 months before he agreed to do this.
I can't tell what's real and what's not anymore. Was there a hologram of Jared Leto?
There was actually a hologram of Jared Leto looking a little bit like one of the Bee Gees. Because he was supposed to be sort of futuristic and everything, but I think he was just Jared Leto that day.
And how did they do this? Was he actually beaming in live to the Comic-Con, or was it pre-recorded?
It was something they did earlier, a bit like Blue Peter. It was a weird little sort of setup on the stage. It was sort of like two triangles that sort of set up on the stage, and he beamed in through one, and then the panel's moderator, Chris Hardwick, appeared in the other and was physically there and not a hologram.
I'm pretty sure Harrison Ford was looking at that thinking, why could I not have had that too? A man who, when he came to Comic-Con for Cowboys and Aliens, was led onto stage in handcuffs in a reference to how little he wanted to be there. Yeah. I saw a couple of video interviews with him today where he just looked like a man who wanted to be far away.
He was
from screaming hordes of people run. Dressed like Indiana Jones. Yeah,
he was, it has to be said, enjoyably grumpy, as he can be. I get the feeling he does share a decent chemistry with Ryan Gosling. The two of them seem to have a little double act going. Any opportunity to Gosling to sort of nudge at him a little bit, they took in the panel. Someone asked the question, what was the most important piece of advice you would give your character? To which Gosling replied, never ever go into Harrison Ford's trailer accidentally. To which Ford just replied, you're damn right. So, yeah, and then Ford was asked whether, in light of the likes of Star Wars and now this, whether he would be rebooting all of his old franchise characters. And apparently he said he would, jokingly, which of course the internet then ran with, Ford announces he's rebooting everything. So, witness 2017, can't wait.
Genuinely can't wait.
Yeah. It's going to be great. Mosquito Coast 2, Mosquito Coastia.
What lies beneath her?
Yep.
Okay.
And maybe another Indiana Jones, maybe a fourth Indiana Jones movie. That'll be great.
It'll never happen. Just unrealistic.
I know. Stupid.
Good footage.
Yeah. They showed the trailer again, which we've all seen online. The one piece of footage they showed was Gosling's character, a Blade Runner named Kay, going into the Tyrell Corporation, or at least what we think is the future of the Tyrell Corporation, to see some old footage, which happens to be the Voight-Kampff test from the original, or a very close-up version of an eye from the Voight-Kampff test of the original film, with Deckard and Rachel talking to each other. And there's some sort of riffing on that a little bit. That was mostly what we saw. It also referenced the fact that there, as the timeline, as I previously mentioned, the timeline between the two films, there has been some sort of attack on
what?
Los Angeles.
Leto, and, you bastard! He's probably responsible. Was he mailing rats to people? En masse, you know, people just open their mail and there's turds.
We're going to get letters if we keep going on about that one. But yeah. So
no one writes in. No one sends letters into a podcast.
Okay. Maybe I'll write one. A fan letter to Chris is the game changer of podcasts.
It is.
Yeah. So it looked interesting. It wasn't exactly if you're doing a movie like Blade Runner where you have incredible vistas and, you know, flying cars and Dave Bautista being a replicant. Spoiler alert, and that sort of stuff. It did seem strange.
A gay replicant?
Just a replicant.
Oh, because you said being gay replicant.
You did say that.
Yeah.
being a replicant.
I thought you said that as well.
So take that again.
Okay.
Take that again.
In a movie where you have visions such as flying cars and an incredible sort of vistas of LA and Dave Bautista as our replicant, it seems strange to have a scene where it's two people in a room talking about a bit of footage, but obviously the link to the original Blade Runner was there, so... Mm-hmm.
And you've got the timeline.
And you've got the timeline.
The timeline.
You've got to keep the timeline.
On a giant screen.
Yep.
2022, Jared Leto sends, mail, loads of mail to people with rats in it.
Origami rats. Justice League,
originally introduced by, Aquaman. Let me take that again. Justice League, it was the sort of the main focal point of the DC panel. But the DC panel actually began with what essentially boiled down to a PowerPoint presentation for a load of future movies, the likes of Wonder Woman 2, yay.
That sounded really sarcastic, that yay. Are you excited about Wonder Woman 2?
I'm very excited about Wonder Woman.
Okay, that needed to be way more exuberant, that yay.
Yay!
That's much better. Thank you.
Yeah, I'm just very tired. It a whole load of movies. Green Lantern Corps,
yay.
Batgirl,
yay.
The Batman.
Yay.
Everything that they've already sort of technically announced, they basically put up there. But the thing was, they didn't then go on and discuss any of them. They literally it was literally just like an advertising hoarding flashing up these things. Okay. And then it was just, okay, we're done. And we segued straight into Aquaman.
Okay.
And they had Jason Momoa, who fresh off a plane from Australia, but you wouldn't know it unless he'd had 17 Red Bulls. And he bounded down the aisle through the middle of Comic-Con, through the middle of Hall H, like a rock star, with his trident, with 5 points, still a trident, and basically announced he was the king. The king is here. And he brought with him some footage. They've been shooting for a little while in Australia, and he brought some footage with a video introduction from director James Wan, talking about the visions he's got and the fact that he's aiming it as an origin story for Aquaman. Mm-hmm. We will be introduced to Atlantis the same way that his Arthur Curry / Aquaman is introduced to it. And then we saw a little bit of footage of a couple of French fishermen finding their line sort of tugged. And
your pardon?
And yes.
Well, this is an unusual direction for the DCEU.
Jason Momoa's gone rogue. What videos are you putting on?
Which then reveals a whole sort of legion of ships flying around under the ocean with shark ships and all sorts of things happening, and that looks very cool. There's a load of concept art for that. A scene of Momoa sort of about to fight somebody, and good times basically. Yeah.
Good times, everybody. So the announced films, or the films that they hinted at, included like the Flashpoint and
Cyborg Dance Party.
And the Batman. There was speculation this week that Ben Affleck was either going to step down from his role as the Batman after Justice League, or maybe be removed, as with Warner Brothers wanting to go in a different direction. And there were rumors and reports that Matt Reeves might want to recast because he's got a trilogy in mind for the Batman, and Ben Affleck is, he's in his mid-40s, and he'd be in his mid-50s by the time it finishes, even though the whole point of this Batman in this universe is that he's an older Batman who's been through it all already. And Ben Affleck kind of said, that's not true.
But he
didn't actually say that, did he?
He didn't flat out deny any of the rumors. What he more specifically said was, "I'm very excited to be playing the role," and the fact that he was thrilled to be able to say, "I'm Batman" at Hall H. So it was sort of attempting to dispel the rumors, but not really actually dispelling them.
So he took the bat fifth.
He did, basically. Yeah. Okay.
All right.
He bat-dodged it.
Yeah, so Justice League. So the footage...
Justice League, new trailer.
Yeah.
Which is now online, which you can see online, which is it's fun.
Starts with Wonder Woman, which I wonder is a kind of reaction to...
It does feel a little bit like that, which is a good thing. Maybe. More Wonder Woman is a good thing. Again, yay! Still didn't sound convincing.
That's better. Yeah, that's better. That's better.
But yeah.
Just very interesting that DC and Marvel both came with a film in which a big group of heroes have to band together to fight some kind of alien who's coming to Earth.
To collect things.
Crush stuff. Mm-hmm. And collect stuff.
Yeah, Justice League, he's collecting Panini stickers, I believe. But in Infinity War, he's collecting the stones. Not the Rolling Stones. Like, oh no, am I being taken away? Keith, help me!
Good grief.
That's Mick Jagger. Very tired.
We apologise.
There's an interesting kind of symmetry there. I guess Infinity War wins the numbers game because there are approximately 5,000 superheroes banding together in that. But yeah, it's just interesting that on the same day, you know, they're kind of probably going head to head.
For the Justice League trailer, much like the panel, more of the fun element of it came from Ezra Miller, who is of course playing Barry Allen /The Flash. Guns N' Roses guitarist / is The Flash.
My God.
He's the jokey, quippy guy among the bunch. There's a little moment where, which you can see in the trailer, where they all meet with J.K. Simmons, Commissioner Gordon, after the bat signal has been turned on. And then Simmons turns around and they've all left except for The Flash, mm-hmm. and he's sort of standing there slightly awkwardly going, oh, so they really do vanish, don't they? That's rude. And then he dashes off at top speed, which of course he can. Mm-hmm. And then there's moments of Jason Momoa looking like he's just enjoying himself a hell of a lot more than anyone else in the cast. and that seemed to be the same thing with the panel. Ezra Miller turned up as he did last year, actually. Last year he dressed as Gandalf. This year he dressed up as an anime character, including a wig, which he then proceeded to treat like a cat on his lap. Oh, and kept saying, stop running away. Which was really funny. He was really naturally really, really charming and funny. Mm. Momoa tried to destroy the chairs like someone finishing off a Who concert, and was actually then forced by the moderator to replace one of the chairs and put it back like a slightly sullen teenager being told to like eat their vegetables. Amazing. Which is really good fun.
Amazing.
So, yeah. There was certainly some fun to be had, I have to admit.
How did the footage play? I mean, I've seen the footage. It's 4.5 minutes of stuff. It looks good. It looks very CG heavy at times, perhaps a little bit unfinished, you might add. It ends tantalizingly with Alfred, played by Jeremy Irons, seeing someone appear, presumably in the Batcave, someone of great power.
Robin.
Robin, clearly, back from the dead in this universe. And Alfred goes, he said you would come, or something like that. And the smart money's in that being, of course, Ted Danson. He's back. He's always around. No, the smart money's in that being Superman, isn't it? Really, Henry Cavill coming back from the dead. He's not dead after all.
You kind of hear, it's like you see the glass. There's a bit of a Jurassic Park moment with the ripples in the water. Feels like that should be someone with a heavy step.
Maybe it's a dinosaur. Maybe it's the
dancing T-Rex.
Dancing T-Rex. We've seen it. That'd be amazing.
So that was basically viral marketing for a thing that we don't actually reveal. But that would be the stealthiest stealth campaign in the history of stealth campaigns.
That'd be amazing. I'm still looking forward to this movie. I'm intrigued to see how it's going to turn out. Obviously, all the behind-the-scenes shenanigans that have been going on. With Joss Whedon coming on as... was he there today, Joss Whedon?
Joss Whedon was not there. I think he's quite busy.
Yeah.
You know, I think also, the film. I don't think he wants to overshadow it, you know, to...
Yeah.
Certainly, I think...
To sort of take ownership of
Ray
it.
Fisher, who plays Cyborg, had a
I Heart ZS.
Said S. Yes. You've been living in the States too long. You literally just pronounced it as C rather than said, which is how it should be pronounced.
World War Z equal doesn't work as well with World War Z equal.
It's Z's dead, not Z's dead.
Yeah. Come on, get with the program, man.
Z is a name.
The thing you want,
not a Z.
So there's a road, right? There's a road.
Yes.
And the thing, the side of the road that people walk on, what do you call that?
The pavement.
That's correct.
Aha, yeah, you can't
catch me
out.
Even though I used the word side and walk in the description.
I haven't gone total colonial.
Okay.
I'm still British in many ways, dude.
All right. So the Justice League footage went down pretty well, I would say. We'll get back to the Marvel stuff later on very, very quickly. We'll talk about some of the other stuff that happened. The Comic-Con kicked off with the Kingsman Golden Circle panel, which we all thought was
hammered on stage on a Thursday morning.
With whiskey, and then we had the entire cast, well, felt like the entire cast in here as well, which was a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun. The footage played down really, really well.
The footage played...
The trailer's online again.
Mm-hmm.
Red Band trailer.
Mm-hmm. And they also played, they, well, Matthew Vaughn, who was not present, he was still editing the film, even though the moderator, Jonathan Ross, called him over FaceTime at one point, and it looked like he was actually relaxing in a swimming pool or next to a swimming pool. Very busy, clearly. and he sent basically the opening of the film, the opening action set piece of the film, mm-hmm. which is extremely mad and extremely fun and essentially mm-hmm. features Taron Egerton's Eggsy being shanghaied or his old former Kingsman wannabe, mm-hmm. Charlie,
mm-hmm.
Trying to shanghai him. Obviously, in some way, he is now a villain.
Mm-hmm. He's always a villain.
He was always a baddie. And that involves an incredibly high-tech cab and Taron Egerton once again having to show off his ability to hold his breath underwater. I won't say too much more than that to avoid sort of giving away spoilers, but it was a hell of a lot of fun and people mm-hmm. really did get into it.
It's a very, very good car chase. It's a very good opening to the film. The trailer seems to have gone down gangbusters, and they seem to be pushing the envelope again in certain directions, shall we say.
Mm-hmm.
I'm very excited about this movie. I think it's going to be fantastic, great fun, very entertaining, like the first one. So, yeah, keep an eye out for that one. And the cast were in good form as well.
The weirdest thing about the Fox panel is that before it even happened, there were a lot of people saying, oh, they'll have to bring some sort of X-Men,
yeah.
Deadpool kind of thing into it. And there was literally nothing else. It was Kingsman, and that was it, which was great. But there was no Ryan Reynolds as Deadpool. There was no video messages. There was no anything.
I expected some Deadpool. I was a bit surprised by that. Just even a little video clip or something.
Yeah,
seems like
given the success of Deadpool,
we were talking because we were journalists occasionally, and we had to prepare for this thing, and we were discussing things in the office, and it comes down as the Fox panel, and we know that Kingsman's going to be there, and you're thinking, well, for sure, there's going to be some sort of X-Men activity because everything's filming at the same time. The New Mutants is filming right now. Deadpool 2 is filming right now. Mm-hmm. I believe Dark Phoenix is filming right now, but. As time went on, it became apparent we'd heard that there was no one from the New Mutants coming. Simon Kinberg told me that he wasn't coming this year. I just felt that, hang on. And then the day before the panel, it changed. If you notice on the Comic-Con website, it changed from the Fox panel to the Kingsman panel.
To the Kingsman panel, yeah.
That's kind of interesting. You know, in the past, I remember Bryan Singer brought footage from X-Men 2 back in 2002. I would say I remember, I wasn't here then, I read about it, but and he'd been filming for a matter of days and still managed to cobble something together, but
yeah. Forget that, I'm just disappointed there was no Geostorm, film which I am increasingly mesmerized by.
Geostorm,
I cannot get bored of repeating the synopsis for this film, just so complicated. So many things going on. I was hoping that would be here with Warner Brothers. There was no It panel. There was a sort of a party where they showed some footage, sort of a small kind of thing, but I was surprised there wasn't a Hall H presentation for It, which...
I'm surprised by that. I'm surprised there was no Dark Tower as well. There was no real Sony presence this year. Sony own Blade Runner 2049 in the UK, but not over here.
Yeah, there was no Mortal Engines, which is the big kind of Peter Jackson, Fran Walsh... written project, which has just wrapped recently in New Zealand. But, you know, it's interesting what stuff comes and what doesn't. You can never quite sort of predict it.
No.
Apart from anything with a superhero.
Even then, the Marvel, the Fox stuff.
Oh, yeah. Good point.
Yep. No superheroes.
Yeah.
It's all interesting.
Yeah.
All right, so we'll race through some of the other stuff very, very quickly. Bright.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's David Ayer. Doing Lord of the Rings, really, but in LA, in modern LA. So it's kind of the sort of I interviewed them for the magazine. You can read that on August 10th when that comes out. But yeah, they talked about how one of the touchstones was District 9, and so the idea is the elves and orcs and all these magical creatures have been living in modern society for hundreds of years. And yeah, Will Smith is a cop whose partner is played by Joel Edgerton as the first ever orc cop, and it looks kind of interesting. It's like fully R-rated. They showed a very violent scene in a gas station with Noomi Rapace playing this elf who's just a complete psycho and has a gigantic machine gun. Things are blowing up and big crunching stunts and stuff. It looks kind of interesting. You can't quite tell which way it's going to go, but they're going for it.
Mm.
I can't think of a, you know, obviously Alien Nation, people have been saying that that's very similar. This is more of an action film than that, I'd say,
okay,
for the looks of it. Mm. I don't know. It looks interesting, but it's obviously going straight to Netflix.
Yep, straight to Netflix.
In December.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
This is an intriguing one. David Ayer is a filmmaker who divides me. I love End of Watch. Love it, love it, love it, love it, love it. And if this is End of Watch with orcs and fairies and elves and goblins and whatnot, then count me in. I'm on board. If it's Suicide Squad 2 with aforementioned elves and goblins and fairies, then dear God, no.
Yeah, I hope it's not. I think Suicide Squad, had several problems. One of them was there were way too many characters. There was way too much going on. It was quite unfocused. This at least has the End of Watch kind of focus of having these two characters and their dynamic between them as they're going around LA in their patrol car and get mixed up in this kind of mystery. I hope it's more End of Watch too.
Do you in any way foresee that Will Smith will get back to his blockbuster roots and sort of come up with the end song for it, which, given that it features magic in Los Angeles, would have to be Wiccan Wiccan Wild Wild West Coast?
Oh, come on. Oh,
dear Lord.
You're the
only ones that can make the jokes.
You've been thinking about that, haven't you?
A little bit.
You've been writing that one down.
A couple of minutes. That was a couple of minutes work.
You've got a tattooed in your wrist. I can see it. Oh my God, it's amazing.
The footage they showed did involve Will Smith whacking a fairy with a broom. There's some really fun stuff in it.
Fingers crossed.
We'll see. Yeah, fingers crossed. Death Note, they was the other part of the Netflix panel on Thursday.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that looked good.
Oh, you saw it? You actually were in the panel?
Yeah, I went to the panel.
You're in the panel. You've seen three things.
Willem the Dafoe voices the demon. There's a sort of technically a death god. I keep saying demon. Technically a death god. I think there's a difference. I apologize to demons and death gods for mixing you up. Willem Dafoe, basically think Groot, but with spikes coming out of it and red eyes, and it likes eating apples for some reason. Haven't read the source manga, but
it's healthy.
I presume that's from that. And Willem Dafoe does the voice. And halfway through the panel, there was a fake Skype call from the demon.
No,
Willem Dafoe kind of going, "Hey everyone," and doing his creepy laugh. And everyone was a bit frightened for a while, but then he went away. So that was quite fun. I thought that looked good.
Yeah,
I thought that looked good. The clip they showed was the arrival of the demon and Light, the hero, kind of meeting him for the first time. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of scary and stylishly done, but also quite funny. There was a bit of kind of an undercurrent of comedy to it. So I really hope that one works out.
This is Adam Wingard. That again is going to be on, is that Netflix or Amazon Prime? It's Netflix.
Netflix.
It's Netflix. It's going to be on Netflix at the end of August. And indeed, Adam Wingard is going to be our podcast guest around that time as well. An interview already recorded and in the bin? In the bin. I put
That's
it in the
unfortunate.
Bin. I put it in the bin.
Put it in the recycle, Chris.
Yeah. I'm so tired that I don't know how I'm going to muster up the enthusiasm to wank over Marvel for a good 10 minutes, but I'll give it a go. What else do we have?
Strange Things. Didn't see the panel, but I just want to, before I forget, the trailer for Stranger Things season 2 is really good.
Yeah.
I just watched it before this, actually, and it's set to Michael Jackson's Thriller, complete with Vincent Price creepy intro.
Mm-hmm.
He would have done a good job with Death Note as well. That's a really good trailer.
It really was. It played like gangbusters in Hall H. It was one of those trailers where
not
you've
like
got
Ghostbusters,
not like which features heavily in it too.
Yeah,
which
is proton pack. Something trapped inside a proton.
Something
pack.
Trapped inside the trap, not the proton pack.
Sorry, inside the yeah.
Ghostbusters 2 fan, you call yourself. Rubbish. And it played really well. It was one of those trailers that people are standing up at the end and demanding they play again. And I believe it was David Harbour, the as described on the panel by moderator Patton Oswalt as Hellboy with a dad bod, who led the call for another viewing of the trailer. It was a really fun panel. I have to admit, the kids. You've probably seen the kids in various little appearances, just being fun, dancing, doing things, and everything. They're very funny. They've got a good, easy chemistry, and there was a very good little rivalry going between Patton Oswalt, the moderator, and Finn Wolfhard, who, as Wald has now christened him, just Finn Wolfhard, the future porn star, because of the name. Finn Wolfhard. So yeah, it's a really good panel, and yeah, the footage looked fantastic. If you're a Stranger Things fan, I'm sure you'll be delighted.
Who isn't a Stranger Things fan? What sort of idiot moron would not even have seen the first season?
Hi, Chris.
What sort of
Chris?
Just galumphing arse.
Ladies and gentlemen, Chris Hewitt.
Anyway.
I think also the Demogorgon, who's now had to go back to his job as a waiter. It's very sad.
Is that a reference to the first season?
Yeah.
I laughed anyway.
You haven't seen it.
I laughed anyway.
I know you did. It's good. You haven't seen
it. You know
what?
It's one of these. It's a show which I also haven't read the spoilers, so I don't know what happens.
Oh, okay.
I just know that there's someone
Your
in the
TV viewing habits as 11. Ever distress me enormously.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Chris watches only the worst TV and reads all the
Yeah, I watch, only the,
the
I watch
TV.
Only the worst TV. Better Call Saul, Billions. Yeah, only the
Master
worst
Chef.
TV.
Late Night
Don't
Master
you
Chef.
Diss MasterChef. Late Night MasterChef is the idea that I've been pitching to BBC for ages. It's like John Giraud and Greg Wallace, but nude.
It's all kicking off, folks. Sooner or later, there's going to be a superhero epic about this particular clash, and it will play Hall H, and no one will ask for the trailer to be played a second time.
No one will want that trailer.
Someone so tight my bollocks, John!
The trailer can be set to Earth Song.
All right. Quiet down. Settle down. Nick, you also went to the Star Trek Discovery panel?
I did. It was... Yeah, I mean, I was hoping for a bit more footage. They showed the trailer.
Which again is online.
And they were very kind of cagey with story stuff. But Jason Isaacs was there, and he rocked it, frankly.
He's amazing, isn't he?
Yeah.
We were hoping to get him on this podcast, but he had to run to go back to LA for a friend's wedding.
Yep.
True story.
So it was goodbye to Jason Isaacs.
It was goodbye to Jason Isaacs.
But yeah, no, that was fun. It was moderated by Rainn Wilson, who you and I walked past. This is possibly the worst anecdote, but maybe probably the best one I'll tell. Yes, we walked past Rainn Wilson in this hotel earlier today. I also walked past. I walked past Beck Bennett.
Beck
from
Bennett.
Saturday Night Live.
Wow.
Who I'm a big fan of him, especially his portrayal of Vladimir Putin. Mm-hmm. He plays Putin opposite Alec Baldwin's Trump. And I walked past him. So there we go. Beck
That's
Beck.
Amazing. Have you walked past anyone?
Have I walked past? Yes. I walked past Michael Giacchino.
I wouldn't even recognize him. How did you?
Well, he had his, if you see his Twitter feed or his Instagram feed, he has often out and about a sort of a trademark sort of whitish trilby.
A massive arrow pointing at himself, emblazoned with the words, "I am Michael Giacchino."
He just has a t-shirt on that just lists all of his puns.
Yeah, I was going to say, was he punning wildly? That would be the first giveaway.
He was not actually punning at the time, but I can believe he had just come from somewhere where he was punning.
Extraordinary.
But yeah, he was my favourite celebrity spot, I think. And our own Emma Thrower, I believe, would have been thrilled to be
she
in his presence.
She would have been. We walked past today Doug Jones.
He was in this room. He was in your chair.
He was in this room.
He was in your chair.
Was he in my chair?
Yeah, he was in your chair.
Hang on, let me just...
No.
Yeah.
He was in that one.
No.
Between you two.
He could be this chair because Doug Jones is a talent for playing anything and anyone.
He looked at the copy of the magazine that we have here and said, "I love Empire. You guys have been good to me."
So
thank you, Doug Jones.
What a lovely guy. I should have said hello to him.
We do love Doug Jones.
I saw him, but
he's
great.
I didn't.
But yeah, that's pretty much, I think that's it. That's pretty much it. Right. So we also saw The Tick as well. That was a decent panel with Peter Serafinowicz, who was on Facebook Live earlier as well. It would be in the magazine also. But that's just very, very quickly this end where we started with Marvel, who dropped a whole ton of news. We'll go through it very, very quickly. So they started off with a very funny pre-recorded recap of the Marvel Cinematic Universe today with Michael Peña and Paul Rudd, who are currently filming Ant-Man and the Wasp out there in Atlanta. And they were basically going through it, in a very comedic, very, very funny fashion. And it turned out to be a bit of a ruse it turned out that there was actually a bit of shadow casting going on there, because they were, it turns out at the end of the video, they weren't recapping the Marvel Cinematic Universe for our benefit. They were recapping it for the benefit of their newest cast member, Michelle Pfeiffer, who has been cast in Ant-Man and the Wasp as Janet Van Dyne, the long-lost wife of Michael Douglas's Hank Pym, who was last seen off in the Quantum Realm. And clearly, they're going to get her back. And she's going to be the Wasp, or a Wasp. So Ant-Man and the Wasp refers to, there's two Ant-Mans in this movie, and there's two Wasps as well. And they showed some concept footage from the movie as well, and some very early stuff that they're shooting. I think they only started last week, or maybe the week before. And they showed some, so there's concept art of Michael Douglas in the Ant-Man suit as Michael Douglas, as he is now, not de-aged, which looked cool. There seems to be all sorts of stuff happening in the Quantum Realm. Clearly they go in there to try and get Janet Van Dyne back. And it ended with Giant Man.
It did.
And skulking around peeking out
a building in San Francisco. Yeah. It looks fantastic.
I'm really excited about this movie. I really like the first movie. It's really grown on me. And clearly, I think they've also recognized that Michael Peña's Lewis is a fantastic supporting character, one of my favorite Marvel characters in the MCU. And they're giving him a lot more to do, which is great.
And Pfeiffer, of course, was not the only announcement they made. They're adding Lawrence Fishburne as a man called Dr. Bill Foster, who is a Marvel Comics character. I believe he's the character of Goliath in the comics. What version of that will be is another matter. We will have to wait and see. This guy was actually announced, they've announced Walton Goggins. Well, they didn't announce Walton Goggins.
Walter Goggles.
Yes, Walter Goggles.
Walter Goggles.
Who had previously been sort of mentioned as being cast in it. And he will, I believe, be the new corporate villain of the film, because it's Walton Goggins wanting to be a villain.
Oh, you Goggles. Yes. I hate you.
And Hannah John Kamen, who also was previously mentioned as cast in the film, and she is playing a character called Ghost. So clearly she's going to be Patrick Swayze wandering around with some pottery. Oh, is that a different ghost? I'm not sure. So yeah.
Exciting stuff. Very, very cool.
It's a cinematic game changer.
It is a cinematic game changer. It's a holy grail of pop culture, that panel. And Captain Marvel... they also announced some big news about Captain Marvel, which is the film is coming out in 2019. I believe this one's coming out after Avengers 3, in between Avengers 3 and Avengers 4, I think. I can't remember. I've completely forgotten how the lineup of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. But some top news about this one. So we knew that Brie Larson is Captain Marvel, Carol Danvers, who is probably the most powerful superhero we will have seen. They will need someone hugely powerful, I would imagine, to fight off Thanos, the purple bastard. And what's interesting about this is that they announced a couple of things. Number one, Sam Jackson is back as Nick Fury in this movie, but he will have two eyes in this film because it is set in the early 1990s, before the MCU really got going. That intrigues me.
Do you think we'll see him losing an eye?
We may well do.
You know how he lost the eye?
I think he... No.
Interesting.
Well, not in this version of the MCU. We haven't been told.
I believe it's an unfortunate accident with a fork. But that hasn't been confirmed yet. That isn't canon, just so you know.
He was like, guys, look at this.
A tragic dining misfortune.
It's like Nick Frost in Hot Fuzz, but he just forgot to stop the fork from actually piercing the eye, and he also didn't have the ketchup either. But, you know. Yeah. It'd be great if Nick Fury had an Uncle Derek.
Derek Fury.
Derek Fury.
He was the reason I got into being furious in the first place. But then he dealt drugs to people. Another big piece of news as well was that the enemies in the movie, and this makes me wonder. This makes me wonder a lot now I'm thinking about this, are the Skrulls. Now the Skrulls, for anyone who doesn't know who or what they are, I'll be very, very brief about this, are a nasty bunch of alien arseholes, and they can shapeshift. They can become whomever they please. And I'm surprised about this. I spoke to Kevin Feige early on tonight, and I completely forgot to ask him about the Skrulls because I'm an idiot and I do part-time journalizing. And I won an award recently, but I don't know why. And I forgot to ask him about the Skrulls. And the Skrulls are interesting because I assumed that they were a Fantastic Four property, that they were aligned with the Fantastic Four. I'm pretty sure their first appearance in Marvel Comics was Fantastic Four, so therefore they're part of that universe. So I wonder if there's been some deal going on there recently to get them over for in exchange for something else.
It was announced, I think it was yesterday, that Noah Hawley, the man behind Fargo and Legion, is currently working, or developing at least, a Doctor Doom movie.
Yes.
So clearly Fox still has a lot invested in the Fantastic Four universe, even if they're not directly aiming at another Fantastic Four movie right now. So perhaps there was some sort of extension of the rights to the Fantastic Four universe, with Marvel then going, well, if you want to keep it, then give us the Skrulls.
That's a bloody good theory. I like that theory. Let's go with that theory. I should have asked Kevin Feige about that theory, but hey-ho, I'm not perfect. I am what you see before you. But it's intriguing, because also the fact that it's set in 1991, I think, roughly, this movie. Why have we not seen Carol Danvers in the previous years, this incredibly powerful character? Is she off-planet, perhaps, by the time that the MCU kicks in, by the time Infinity War starts? We know she's not going to be in Infinity War. She'll be in the fourth Avengers movie. So where is she? What is she doing? What is she up to? And also, just a very, very quick thing about the Skrulls. The Skrulls really interest me because they can change the game in a way, aren't they? They're a bit of a cinematic game changer, aren't they? Because you could suddenly have a situation where you could retcon a lot of the MCU to go, that wasn't who you thought it was, that was a Skrull.
They could do that. They could do that.
Setting it before the MCU really kicked into gear is certainly interesting.
I'm reading up on them now. They're on Wikipedia, their entry for Skrulls is approximately 90,000 words.
Yeah.
You'll be interested to hear that they have chins with several vertical folds in the skin below their mouths.
Yeah, this is true. This is true. They're ugly buggers.
That is a cinematic game changer.
That is a cinematic game changer. All right, I won't talk any more about
that.
I
love this.
But
Skrulls are all able to assume virtually any form, be it organic, e.g. cows, or inorganic, e.g. lamp.
Wow.
So that's an actual line.
Britt Tamland clearly wrote the
they have two options. They can change into cows or lamp, whichever is more useful.
That's a plan for planetary domination if ever I heard one.
Beely cow or beely lamp. My word. Alright, sorry about this being so long, but very, very quickly as well. So we have the Black Panther footage, which they screened tonight, and I don't think is going to be online.
Not online.
And the cast, and the clearly Ryan Coogler had seen it, the director, but the cast, who were out in force tonight, it was Chadwick Boseman, and Lupita Nyong'o, and Michael B. Jordan, and Letitia Wright, and
Danai
Gurira, and Daniel Kaluuya, and Forrest Whitaker was there, of course. Winston Duke was there. Fantastic.
Mr. Andy Serkis.
Great stuff. And the footage, Blanco, I thought looked really interesting, looked really cool. It doesn't feel like anything else we've seen in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. There was a big casino fight sequence that felt very much like a James Bond film to me. You got to see Andy Serkis as Ulysses Claw back again with a prosthetic arm that became what Andy Serkis told me later on was a sonic disruptor, because Claw in the comic books uses sound as a weapon. And there's a batshit insane car chase. And
what's insane about it?
You're putting me on the spot here.
Sorry.
But it's Black Panther chasing after Ulysses Claw and dismantling the car around him. Essentially, while the car chase is going on, it looks really slick, really, really fun. The cast are seem to be having a great time, and they all seem to be incredibly proud to be in this film, which is, you know, an extraordinary You know, obviously people will say it's long overdue in the Marvel Cinematic Universe that we're going to be 17 films in by the time we have a film with an African-American lead, and we're going to be 20 films in by the time they have a film with a female lead. But the Black Panther is very hard to overstate the fact that this is an African-American director with an African-American cast, by and large.
It's a landmark, yeah.
Many of the roles behind the camera, cinematographer, et cetera, are all African-American people as well.
It's
great.
Yeah.
I think it's going to be a fantastic thing to see, and it feels different and feels cool in a way that I think we haven't seen so far in the MCU. So, yeah. I thought the footage looked fantastic. I also thought the Thor Ragnarok footage was extended Thor Ragnarok footage, and the revelations from that, things like, for example, this is a new version of Hulk that we haven't seen before in the MCU, mm-hmm. which is great because Hulk is probably my favourite Marvel character, and the psychological changes that character has undergone over the years are terrific and layered and complex, and I'm glad to see this finally being explored, this complex relationship that between Banner and Hulk, these two psyches occupying the same body. Who knows where it could go in the future, but we have a Hulk who won't let Banner back in his own body from what we've been told, and Hulk has developed now a limited vocabulary, a bit like us after doing 4 days of Comic-Con and then doing a podcast. But I thought the footage looked great. So we started off with Thor being captured after shit's gone down, things have gone wrong, and he ends up in the planet Sakaar, which is run by Jeff Goldblum, who effectively is playing himself, but he's also playing Benicio Del Toro's brother, the Collector from Guardians of the Galaxy, and he is the Grand Master, and he has this place set up as a gladiator planet, and we saw a couple of scenes with Thor being interrogated by the Grand Master and Valkyrie, played by Tessa Thompson, and another character whose name I didn't get, but played by Rachel House.
I believe it was Topaz.
Topaz.
I believe she's called Topaz.
Okay. Played by Rachel House, who is Taika Waititi's good luck charm. Mm-hmm. Has been in pretty much all of his films. Most recently, most notably, of course, Hunt for the Wilder People. Mm-hmm. And that was a very, very fun scene. There's another fun scene where Thor then is imprisoned and meets this character called Korg.
Korg,
played by Taika Waititi, who's a pile of rocks, and that was a very, very funny scene as well. And then we got a glimpse of the Hulk versus Thor battle as well, followed by the trailer. And the film looks great. It looks technicolor and mad, and unlike anything we've seen in the MCU. Mm-hmm. There's a real boldness about what they're doing right now, which I think is terrific. And it looks really funny.
It's the thing. People have tried to level this criticism at the MCU that it's a factory, and it's basically the management imposing their will on all the various directors. And this sort of film just completely refutes that, because it feels like a Taika Waititi film that just happens to take place in the Marvel Universe. It's fantastic. Mm. There's some true comedy in here. Korg, for example, tells Thor that he's in prison because he tried to start a revolution, but he didn't print enough pamphlets, and only his mum and his mum's boyfriend turned up, and he doesn't like the boyfriend. It's brilliant. It's the sort of thing you literally could not imagine something like that happening in, say, the Justice League's world. It's just... Yeah.
Well, the baby steps for that in the universe, you know. Yeah. Wonder Woman was such a great film, then, I think.
That's true. But yeah, it's such a wonderful little scene, utterly unexpected. It's just those little moments of real, just comic gems that you just love.
And you got a wider sense of the idea of behind the film as well. So you get a sense that Thor and Asgard are being attacked, and by Cate Blanchett's Hela, things go to shit. Mjolnir gets destroyed, everything goes wrong, and they end up at Sakaar, and then Thor has to put together a team, which in this movie was Thor and Banner/Hulk, Loki, which is interesting, and Tessa Thompson's Valkyrie. How that then ties into the things we already know about this movie, that Thor ends up on Earth with Doctor Strange and Loki looking for Odin, I have no idea. I have no idea how this movie's going to come together, but this is a very, very promising start.
Definitely.
And then very, very last thing, very, very quickly, the Infinity War trailer, which we talked about a little bit already. It's not a trailer. It was more a selection of footage.
A sizzle reel more than anything. A sort of an early look at certain things. I mean, but Thanos, for example, apparating in. and a lot of shots of the various Marvel heroes having quite a bad time of it. It looked like Thor was almost having his head crunched at one point.
Yeah, by Thanos, yeah.
Yeah, there's a moment of Spider-Man, Tom Holland Spider-Man, seeing the sort of the hairs on his arm raise up as though he's getting his spider sense for the first time with Thanos' ship sort of approaching Earth. It looks fantastic. It looks huge. And this is early days. They wrapped what, a week ago, something like that. Very recently on this first film, and it looks absolutely massive.
Yeah.
It promises to be like nothing else they've seen.
I genuinely think this is the most ambitious film ever made. I cannot think of anything else has even come close to it in terms of the ambition and scale.
I think you're missing out Sex Lives of the Potato Man.
I am missing out Sex Lives of the Potato Man. But
honestly, Chris.
It could be things could go horribly wrong, but I'm really excited about it and the footage delivered.
To be fair, Fitzcarraldo, people carried a boat over an actual mountain. That's pretty ambitious.
That's true, but Thanos would have just grabbed that boat and just had it delivered. Or Jared Leto would have just mailed it to someone. A massive envelope.
Bigger scale. I'll give you bigger scale.
Bigger scale.
Don't know about most ambitious, but yeah.
It's incontrovertibly the most ambitious film ever made. But, you know, that's not an argument for another day, because I just said incontrovertibly. No, you can't controvert that. You can't. Because I've just said incontrovertibly.
Most ambitious as in no one has ever been more ambitious in making a film.
Yeah, in terms of the size of the in terms of the size of the film, the size of the cast, the scale of the movie. It's never been done before. Right. That is the end of the Comic-Con news section. Dear God, as this podcast goes into its fourth day. Time for another guest. Our next guest, in fact, is our next guests. We've had a whole bunch of people come to our studio over the last few days, and included the entire cast of Marvel's Inhumans. They were all here.
They really were.
657 of them, and they also wrote with them the showrunners Scott Buck and Jeff Loeb, and director Ruul Renee, and they talked to me, and this is before the footage screening, by the way, which didn't go down terribly well is my understanding, but they talked to me about the show and their ambitions for the show, and it's a decent little chat. Enjoy it. We're delighted to be joined on this very, very special Comic-Con edition of the Empire Podcast by Ruul Renee, Jeff Loeb, and Scott Buck. How are you, sirs?
Very good, thank you.
Awesome.
What's your Comic-Con experience been like so far? What's the strangest thing you've seen?
I don't think we've seen anything other than elevators and corridors so far.
Well, I saw Spider-Man in an elevator last night, so...
You're lucky.
Am I one up?
You are definitely one up.
I saw from the bus the big poster was hanging.
Yes, that was nice, the whole side of the building.
Yeah.
That's good. That means you know it's imminent, right?
Yes.
When you get in and you see the poster.
Mickey Newman poster hanging on the billboard. Yeah, that's pretty good.
Absolutely. Jeff, I imagine you're not, this isn't your first rodeo at Comic-Con.
No, it still is great fun. The having a presence as big as Inhumans here, the show's so big that it couldn't be contained to a television screen. It had to go on an IMAX screen. Taking up most of Petco Park, which is a baseball field, for those of you that don't know, is just, it's great. And it also speaks to the commitment that ABC and IMAX have to, you know, getting the word out about the show.
So this show started in a very, very strange way. It was announced a couple of years ago, as part of the MCU, part of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. When it switched to TV, did anything that the Marvel Studios development team had been working on, did anything come with that, or was it very much a clean slate for everything?
As far as I know, they actually hadn't done anything. It was, as it is with the movie division, they announced their slate. This was something that was going to be in 2019, and I think they announced it in like 2014, so they hadn't yet started. They just knew that it was a slot.
Okay.
And that was part of the reason why, when we suggested perhaps it was something that could work in television, they really hadn't given enough work done on it for it to be anything that couldn't be moved over.
Okay. And Scott, can you talk about the approach to this property, which even for Marvel is outlandish, and you could go wrong with this in a lot of ways. How did you go about
it? It's funny because it doesn't seem outlandish at all to me, and I think it's just because our approach is always through character. You know, who are these people? What are they thinking? What are they feeling? Why did this happen? You know, when we first meet them, they're in the midst of this huge family crisis that threatens their entire civilization. And so it's like, how did they get to this point? And so it's just approaching them as if they are real people.
So you look at it in terms of genre, how would you describe the show then?
I myself tend to think of it as a family drama, you know, but dark at times, funny at times. But, you know, yes, they happen to have superpowers, but I don't think those superpowers define who they are necessarily. Mm.
But there does seem to be, with this show in particular, even more of a cinematic feel to it. And Rule, obviously, you directed the first two episodes with those great big wacky IMAX cameras.
Yes. What? They're not that big. We used the digital IMAX cameras, so they're not the small refrigerator cameras.
Okay. I just have this image of the IMAX camera being as big as the
screen.
Yes,
me too. When we were talking about doing it in IMAX, the first thing I asked to Marvel is that I want to play with the cameras and see what I could do with it. Because I wanted to throw them around and do crazy things with it. And so I did a very nice test with the IMAX cameras and could feel what you could do with it and how you can push the limits.
Okay. So visually, what can we expect from this show?
Yeah, it's grand. It's big. It's a different kind of feeling of doing a TV show for IMAX. So the sets we build have scope to the top and the bottom instead of doing it wide. The way I used the camera and placed it and moved it around. It's different than you normally do television. There's no regular coverage like a medium and a close-up. No, I'm moving the camera really low and really high. And funny enough, when I did the test, there are not a lot of IMAX lenses around. So I asked them to create a wider lens to be even wider. So they built a special lens for our show that we used, but it made it even wider than you ever see on IMAX.
And one of the things that we had talked about from the very beginning is that not only did we have the challenge of how to make it work for an IMAX screen, we also had the challenge of, okay, how are we going to do this so that it's also going to work on ABC and throughout the world on a regular television set? And that's sort of a composition of story and direction and cinematography in the sense that just making sure that the frame is something that will work big and can work smaller. One of the things that we learned very quickly is that on an IMAX screen, movement from left to right is huge. And so one of the things that we spent a lot of time talking about, and one of the things that you'll see when you see the show is that most of the movement is sort of upstage and downstage. So
it
has sort of a theatrical, in the sense of a play, kind of feel to it, even though it's not a play. I mean, it has all the Marvel action, things like that. Yeah. But you'll see, like, for example, if there's a chase in the jungle, we tend to go into the jungle and we tend to come out of the jungle as opposed to going across through the jungle.
Is this something that maybe you might apply to other Marvel TV shows now?
I think one of the things we're very proud of is that every show has a look, every show has a feel, and you know, this was the thing that was right. One of the things that's remarkable about the story is that it's the first sort of family drama that Marvel's done. And that this is the story of royals, and so it's very much a world that you sort of rarely get a glimpse into, but as you often find out when you see these kinds of programming, is that their problems are very similar to your problems. It's just because there happen to be a king and a queen doesn't mean they're not fighting, and their brother still is a pain in the ass. So we've tried to make the story at its core a story of two brothers, one of whom thinks that the city that they live in should be ruled one way, and a brother who thinks that they shouldn't, and a woman who's caught in the middle of it, and so that's just, it's just a very non-complex story, so that you can pick a side and get involved and see where it's going to go.
And obviously, those two brothers, one of them can't speak. The lead of your show can't speak. What are the challenges inherent in that, Scott?
Well, to be clear, he can speak.
He can speak,
he
but he
can speak
he
if he wants
speak.
To destroy everything he's known.
Yeah.
So it's very challenging to create not just an episode or a scene, but an entire series, 8 episodes, around someone who can't speak. But fortunately, with Anson Mount, we found such a terrific actor who was capable of bringing that person to life. And it's also just a matter of making sure that even though this person isn't speaking, he is still driving the story. He is the center of everything that's happening. So I think as long as you keep that in mind, then it all sort of works.
But as writers, you must be going, oh, well, I'll write a scene where Black Bolt stubs his toe and just, oh, no, he can't, because there you go, that city destroyed.
There's a lot of toe-stubbing scenes that we cut from the show.
And then just very quickly about the scale of the powers depicted. I mean, and Rule, you can speak to this as well as a director, because these are incredible. Again, go back to that word, outlandish powers. How do you depict them on the big/small screen?
No, the thing is that, and what I liked about the approach that Scott and Mao and you guys have had is that they wanted to ground it really much. I mean, they didn't want to extend it. You know, they didn't want to make it really big. It needs to be very realistic. Mm. So the approach was very realistic. You know. And not emphasize it too much. It was more in generality that we are seeing these powers, what I really liked. But at the moment that something goes wrong or something goes wrong with Black Bolt and he does say a little puff, then of course the cars are flying through the street. And so that was really cool to do that and find the technical way and to find the IMAX way to make it as beautiful as possible.
Medusa's hair.
Yeah, but it was pretty exciting because we were doing this in downtown Honolulu. And when I remember when we were scouting, I wanted to have the most busiest corner in the most difficult producible place to flip the car. And we did. You know, we pulled it off.
Fantastic. As someone who's been reading these comics for many, many years, Lockjaw is a particularly favorite of mine.
And will be in the show.
Yeah, and seems to be owning Comic-Con. I mean, it was at the Marvel booth yesterday. Obviously, there's that massive Lockjaw plushie that's in the Marvel booth.
Which is not as big as the dog that's in the show, if you get an idea.
It is,
we set out from the very beginning to make sure that first of all, that it was believable.
Yeah.
But that also that we would challenge our cast to having to act with basically a tennis ball, or Stuffy, who was the size of him, but was made out of styrofoam, and so there would be this large blue thing that was sitting in the middle of the street
on wheels, and so we could roll in,
and then we would take the shot, and we'd roll it back out again. And then we really have to give credit where credit's due. Double Negative, which is the production house, or D-Neg. Created the shame of it is that people are going to think that we used a real dog and then placed him in the shot, as opposed to what we did, which was we created 100% CG character, which for television is impractical at best. It looks amazing, and it looks amazing in IMAX, and it'll look like this will be the show that people go, did you see the show with the dog?
Yeah, the giant teleporting dog.
It has, you know, just this awesome cast and terrific story.
And you can make the dog heal, you can make the dog do walkies, you can make the dog do whatever you want. That's that's the beauty of it when it's all CG.
And all he eats are little digital bits.
Very, very last thing. Did you each get a plushie?
Not yet.
No.
Oh,
no. No,
I want one.
I can't give you one, real man. I don't have them on me. Look around. I don't have
anything. I think I have to go to the booth and stand in line for it, probably.
You don't have to stand in line. You directed The Inhumans, for God's sake. Honestly, go now and get some. Brilliant. Rule, Jeff, Scott,
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Okay, so that was The Inhumans, people. I haven't seen the footage, so I don't know if it's as bad as people say, but we shall see. Inhumans is hitting... When's it coming out? August?
It launches in September in the States. They've actually got an interesting idea, which is the first 2 episodes will be in IMAX cinemas on September the 1st, I believe.
Right.
Before the show launches in the US on the ABC network, which is where, of course, the Marvel's Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. already plays.
Amazing. And speaking of IMAX, we should talk about this week's big movie release, which is on IMAX and in 70 millimeters, and just coming in your ears and eyeballs. It's Christopher Nolan's Dunkirk, his latest slice of five-star brilliance. It's basically the only big movie out back in the UK. I'm sure a lot of you have already seen it by the time this podcast is out. Nick here wrote the five-star review for Empire Magazine. This is obviously Chris Nolan's latest movie. It is about the evacuation of Dunkirk in 1940. Britain's soldiers were up against it in France, and they mounted a mass evacuation, and they enlisted thousands of civilian boats to come to the beaches of Dunkirk, where 400,000 men were trapped, being trapped by the Germans, and got them out of there, and lived to fight another day, and ultimately, I don't know, spoiler, prevailed. But this movie, Nick, wow. Yeah.
No, it's an experience. I mean, it is in many ways a sensory assault. I think it's about 3 minutes into the film when the first bullets start flying. And it's not entirely action, but it does feel like one giant set piece that stretches out over an hour, 40-something minutes. It's Christopher Nolan's shortest film since his first film, Following.
Oh, wow.
But there's a reason for that. It's full on. It's intense. I can't think of another film right off the top of my head that is as consistently suspenseful and tense and racks up the kind of the situation like it does. It cuts between land, sea, and air. Tom
yep.
Hardy's in a Spitfire.
Yep, along with Jack Loudon.
Yep. Mark Rylance is on the sea in a boat, and he's one of the civilians, British civilians, who's going across the channel to try and pick people up and mm-hmm. sort of a rescue mission. And then on the beach, you have Finn Whitehead and Harry Styles and others who are just trying to stay alive. And they're basically running from one, like, almost deadly situation to another. Mm-hmm. And just one step ahead of keeping, just mm-hmm. trying to keep themselves alive. And
so the stuff on the beach, the mole part of the film, the beach is called the mole.
Yeah.
It takes place over a week. You could quibble. You don't really get a sense of that time.
It's really
unfolds.
About 2.5 days.
It feels like 2.5 days.
I've seen it a couple of times. It's 2.5 days. But they say it's a week.
Yeah.
Who are we to quibble?
Well, absolutely.
In the boat, it's a day.
A day. Yeah.
And up in the sky, it's an hour.
Mm-hmm.
And they, if you've seen Inception, the kind of the last sort of stretch of Inception where they're different, operating on different dream states and time is moving at different speeds. He's kind of repeating that, but for an entire film. And it's very effective. I've seen it twice. The first time I did get a little bit confused about a few details. You see a plane land twice, and the same plane turns out to be. But it's very meticulously done. He's obviously planned it out to the nth degree. Every shot has been planned and map charted out, and it's just a very, very effective film.
It's absolutely fantastic. I don't think it's my favorite Chris Nolan. I think The Dark Knight is still my favorite. I still love The Prestige. Long-time listeners to the Empire podcast will know I'm not. I don't look favorably upon Memento, but certainly I think this film blew me away. It's extraordinary. I don't think I have had palms this sweaty since Green Room. It's an extraordinary thriller. And what
I was just going to say it's very interesting. There are certain decisions he makes. It's very dialogue light. It really is extraordinarily.
Absolutely.
There are whole stretches that are just basically silent. I mean, it's never silent because Hans Zimmer's coming at you
hammering away in his organ.
Yeah, it's a nerve jangling score, there's bombs and explosions going off and all sorts. But it's in terms of dialogue, it's very light. Kenneth Branagh has some dialogue where he kind of sets up the situation, but very little, I'd say.
It's incredible, and you never see, apart from you see a couple of German planes as Tom Hardy and Jack Loudon, who's in a different Spitfire, are taking on some German pilots, but otherwise you don't see the enemy in this film. You don't see the German soldiers as they shoot at the British soldiers. You don't see a German U-boat as it tries to sink a British ship. You're absolutely in there at the grunt's eye level, and you're more immersed in it than I think I can remember in any war film, certainly you know, not even something like Full Metal Jacket. It's extraordinary. And some of the decisions that Nolan takes in this movie, he doesn't give you character names. He doesn't give you backstory. He doesn't give you something to grab onto. You know, the Cillian Murphy's character in this movie, who's a major character in the film, is credited at the end as Shivering Soldier, not even given a name. There's, you know, and you know, if we could talk about some other characters, but I don't want to give too much away. But there are interesting developments with character names all the way through the film. You're absolutely right about the dialogue, and it feels to me like an extraordinary achievement. It's incredibly tense. It's really well acted. I think this is absolutely going to be one of the front runners for Best Picture. For Best Director, I don't think it's going to be in the running for any acting awards, because I don't feel anyone's really given a big acting scene. But everyone's terrific.
Maybe Mark Rylance for supporting.
Maybe Mark Rylance because he's, you know,
because he's Mark Rylance.
He's been, and you know, he's doing a dependable Mark Rylance kind of thing. I think Tom Hardy's fantastic. I mean, it's a performance that's largely about his eyes and the occasional line that if you can make it out. He's great. You know, a lot of people were worried about Harry Styles for One Direction being in this movie. Again, turns out to have a lot to do, and a lot of the emotional heavy lifting in the movie is actually given to Harry Styles.
Apparently, he's fine. He was only given one direction by Christopher Nolan, and that was act well.
Oh my god!
Sorry, it's very late.
Oh my word! I think that's time for Shira Deli's. It's time for us to go for ice cream. We have a Comic-Con tradition here. Every time we come to Comic-Con, because we're so busy, we don't get to really go out much. Every Saturday night, we reward ourselves with a trip to Shira Deli's, the ice cream place. And it is so close. It's so tantalizingly close. I can taste it. And I think Nick has just brought this podcast to an end with that. And I just want to say as well, thank you so much for your patience. I realize that this is going to be a long podcast, and if you've stuck with us this far, then you'll come with us a little further. But there's so much to talk about at Comic-Con this year. It's been a really interesting year. I don't think it's a bumper crop of stuff, but there's so much to talk about, and it's you know, wow. But yes, thank you for your patience in listening to this, listening to three tired people droning on for ages about movies that you haven't seen and footage you haven't seen. Dunkirk, the big film out this week. It is fantastic. Go and see it. I didn't see it in IMAX. I didn't see it in 70mm, but it is great. It's a visual treat. Go and see it in the biggest cinema that you can possibly find. 5 stars, deservedly so, for Chris Nolan. And that is it for this very special edition of the Empire Podcast, brought to you from Comic-Con. Thank you again so much for your patience and listening to this. Join us next week for more film-related fun, where we'll be joined by Kumail Nanjiani, who's the star and co-writer of the brilliant comedy The Big Sick. Until then, it is goodbye from Blanco.
Goodbye, all.
It's goodbye from Nick.
Excelsior.
Who's a holy grail of pop culture. You really are. You really, you're a cinematic game changer. It's amazing. And it's goodbye for me. I'm off to help these guys eat some ice cream, first and foremost, but also write the 26 pages of award-losing coverage that we're going to write for the next issue of Empire. That's going to be fun. Happy Sunday, everybody. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.